Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are going on over there. You can don't go to the events page. Not right now, unless you're listening to this later on. There's nothing going on there, as you know, because we are still in that great quarantine of 2020. Chad's cranking out content. I'm cranking out content. Cranking out this content, because we've got nothing else that we can do. All we can do is create content for you to absorb, so that's what we're trying to do. Chad, how's the creating of content going for everyone else that's stuck at home with nothing to do?
Well, I'm trying to stay busy. I'm doing these weekly videos. I'm working on my my book for 1517, Unveiling Mercy. I'm trying to write like 15 of those devotions a day. I'm like just coming up with anything to make sure that my mind stays occupied. My wife and I are going on long walks in the evenings, at least to get out of the house. I mean, some people are like just kind of barricaded at home, but yeah, we're like, we can at least walk around the neighborhood and get a little exercise, get a little fresh air.
Yeah, man. There's people, depending on what state you live in, you just straight can't leave your house.
Yeah, you're just like stuck inside.
I mean, if you actually leave your house, you're not on the way to the pharmacy. You get like stopped by the police and told to go home.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. But I mean, I'm doing pretty good because I got plenty of work to keep me busy. But dealing with the same struggles, I guess everybody else is just kind of wanting this to end. But until it does, we'll keep putting out plenty of podcasts, videos, articles, whatever we can keep people's minds on the good stuff.
We had done the Formula of Concord series, and I think we're about to start something. Chad and I are going to do a series with Scott, so probably this is a really great time for you to go over to the YouTube channel, go ahead and subscribe to that, because basically all the video content that we do ends up there. So it might appear in other places as well. But if you want a place to subscribe where you won't miss any content, then that's where you should go. And you just subscribe, ring that bell, then you'll get all the videos all the time. And they're all in one place. You just peruse. There's hundreds and hundreds of videos over there of us doing different things. So check it out. All right, Chad, where are we at in the story of Jephthah? I believe we're in the twilight of this story.
We are, yeah. We wrapped up chapter 11 last time, which is the major part of Jephthah's story. That beautiful, heartwarming story of Jephthah. it was quite a story. I mean, when you look at especially the latter half of it, once you get to the vow that he made, it gets super dark and just kind of shows you where Israel was during this time. Jephthah's kind of a representative of the spiritual cancer that was afflicting Israel. I mean, and I think, having said that, I think it's important to point out that a lot of these judges, they are called by God to be the divinely designated deliverer of Israel. But at the same time, they're sort of a representative of Israel as a whole. And by that, I mean, like, when you look at them, you're kind of getting a picture of the same problems that are afflicting the whole nation. So their personality with their weaknesses is a reflection, really, of the nation as a whole. So, yeah, they're called by God to be a deliverer, a savior of Israel. But at the same time, they mirror back the problems that are afflicting Israel. We see that with Jephthah. And we're going to see that especially with Samson, whom we'll get to just in a few minutes. So kind of can bear that in mind when you're reading through the book of Judges too, that they kind of serve that dual purpose, used by God, but also mirror the problems that are leading Israel into idolatry and all sorts of other law breaking at the time.
Well, it's interesting that the judges, I mean, it's not like, you know, when a judge is called, it doesn't read like other things may read. It doesn't say, and you know, the nation was idolatrous and doing what was displeasing in the sight of God, except for the family of blank. And right. Then God goes, and there's like some righteous dude that's like, you know, holding the line of orthodoxy, and God's like, well, you're going to be the deliverer. No, it's always like, then there's this guy, and he was like the son of a prostitute hanging out with some bums. Then there was this other guy. Like judges are just like, God just selects a guy, and he doesn't seem like he's any better or more. He's just like another guy, just another Israelite that's probably caught up in idolatry, not doing the right things, and God just decides that he's the guy. It doesn't seem like God's like scanning around looking for like, is there anyone that's not, you know, that's holding fast to my precepts? It does not seem like this is the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean the real mark of holiness is how you drink water out of a river, right? Yeah, do you drink like a dog or not?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it is seemingly like God just kind of throws a dart, and wherever it lands, he's like, all right, I can use that guy. There's nothing really special about him, but I'll make use of him. And I mean, that's certainly the way that Jephthah was, and Samson's going to be the same way. He's a little bit different in that he is called from the womb, but as he grows up, of course, he ends up just being another typical Israelite that is way too engrossed in the ways of the Canaanites.
And in a lot of ways, I think Samson, or maybe in every way, Samson is sort of the most Christological of all the judges, partially just due to the fact that you have it straight from birth.
Right, yeah. Straight from birth, and then also his death, the way that he dies, and the effects of that.
His beginning and end are pretty Christological.
Yeah, yes, they are. They certainly are. But before we get to Samson, I guess we need to finish up our last judge, Jephthah. So I don't know exactly why they stopped the chapter where they did, because there's another seven verses they could have included on chapter 11. I guess they thought it was getting too long already. But the story is going to end of Jephthah with chapter 12, verse 7. Really, there's one more instance that takes place. And this is a mirror image of what happened earlier in the case of Gideon. Remember that that after Gideon had gone on the warpath and defeated his enemies, that the men of Ephraim came to him and they're like, hey, why didn't you include us? You know, we wanted to fight. Why didn't you include us? And Gideon's like trying to kind of calm their fears, trying to calm their anger. He's saying, hey, you know, you guys are better than us, and you've done a whole lot more than we have. So he kind of patting them on the back to try and calm them down. And it works. It says that their anger subsided. But now we're going to have kind of a replica of that story at the beginning of chapter 12. And it's not going to work so well in this case. And Jephthah, when he responds to them, rather than calming them, is going to actually incite their anger even more. So what happens is, beginning of chapter 12, these Ephraimites, they cross over to where Jephthah's at. And they say, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? And then they go on to say, we're going to burn your house down on you. I don't get these Ephraimites. I mean, they're like, they're so eager for war. And then they jump to these conclusions. And then they just throw out these threats. Like, there's no chance for Jephthah even to answer them. Like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to burn your house down on top.
These kind of sound like the guys that maybe you do want to take to war, though. I mean, maybe you know, Jephthah really needs to make a note of, like, next time I go fight, I got to invite these guys. Yeah. They keep getting very upset. Like, they are ready to go. So I really do invite them, or else I'm going to have to fight with them. And might as well have them fight for me. So another error on Jephthah's part should have, if you're going to war, if you're going to another battle, man, got to bring these guys up. Like, they are anxious.
Yeah, they are eager to fight. So, well, Jephthah's response is interesting. So after they ask their question and then issue their threat, he responds in kind of it's a little bit difficult to translate, honestly. The Hebrew there is just a little bit unclear. It's hard to bring out an English translation, but my translation, for instance, says, I and my people were at great strife with the sons of Ammon. And then the ESV has, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites. But in the Hebrew, it begins by him saying to them, Ish Riv Hayiti, which means, I am a man of strife. And then it goes on to say that my people also had strife with the Ammonites. But the very opening words are the way in which Jephthah seems to indicate, look, don't mess with me because I'm a man of strife. I know how to strike. I know how to fight. And I had a fight with the Ammonites. And by implication, if you want to fight with me, well, I'm game. But it's, like I said, it's kind of hard to bring all that out in the English translation. But that's the way, that's his opening words, is that I am a man of strife.
Is that basically him saying, I'm your Huckleberry? Is that what that is?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. Yeah, I'm your Huckleberry. You want to fight? I'm ready. So he goes on to say, "What? Who knows whether this is true or not? I mean, this is Jephthah. And the guy likes to talk, as we've seen. I mean, he's a big talker. No one talks more in the book of Judges than Jephthah does. And as we saw last time, his talking gets him into some serious problems. I mean, into some terrible, awful, dark problems in the case of his daughter. But he says, now we don't know if this is true or not. He says, when I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. So he seems to indicate, hey, I went to you. I asked if you wanted to fight. Who knows who's telling the truth? Are the Ephraimites telling the truth? Is Jephthah telling the truth? We really don't know. But whatever it is, he claims that they did. And goes on to say, when I saw you would not deliver me, well, I took my life in my own hands. And I crossed over against the sons of Ammon. And the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? So Jephthah's kind of, he starts out with this, I'm your Huckleberry. And then he claims to say that he tried to get them involved in this. And they didn't. They weren't cooperative. This is one of those cases where I don't know who to believe. It really doesn't matter, because when you get to the end of it, he's basically saying, if you want to fight, let's fight. So that's what happens. It says that Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and he fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, this is kind of a slander, a slur that the Ephraimites said against Jephthah and his men. You are the fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh. Now this is interesting because, so the Ephraimites are saying, you are fugitives to Jephthah and his men. Now, in the very next verse, everything's going to be turned around. And instead, it's the people of Ephraim who are going to become fugitives. So I'll read that verse, verse 5. And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan opposite Ephraim. And it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, let me cross over, the men of Gilead would say to him, are you an Ephraimite? If he said no, then they would say to him, say now, Shibboleth. But he said, Sibboleth, for he couldn't pronounce it correctly. And then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. And there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. And then Jephthah gets his whole life summarized at the end in one verse. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. And then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead.
That's not just like a little skirmish, man.
I know. That's
a lot of guys.
This is like, I mean, how many people were left of Ephraim after that? Yeah, I mean, if these are literal figures, 42,000.
I mean, especially for that day. I mean, that's a big battle back in the day. I mean, it's a big battle now. I mean, if you lost that many guys in a battle, that's a lot. Yeah, back then, that was a ton.
Yeah, this wasn't like one little city of the Ephraimites coming and saying, hey, why didn't you include us? This sounds like the whole tribe is involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, like if when you're reading this at first, you think there's about to be like a West Side Story street fight, you know, about you have like 30 guys on each side, and they're going to settle this thing because one guy threatened to burn some other guy's house down. They're going to settle this straight thing like men, you know, out there going to meet on the playground and they're going to do this thing. Now, there's a 40-something thousand guys die? Like, what in the world?
Yeah, this is not a skirmish. This is an all-out war that goes on. So everything gets turned around. The Ephraimites are slandering the men of Gilead, saying, ah, you're just fugitives. You're kind of runaways. And then after they get defeated, they end up being the fugitives. They end up being the runaways. And we have this this almost, if it wasn't so fatal, it'd be a comical situation that all has to do with how you say certain words, right? This is all about accent and patterns of speech. So in at the crossings of the Jordan River, of course, these guys are trying to get away, right? And I guess there's only certain places where they're going to be able to cross the river. Well, the men of Gilead, they take possession of these crossings, these fords. And when an Ephraimite would show up, they'd say, all right, you know, what's the password, basically? Say Shibboleth. But I guess whatever it was, they couldn't pronounce the SH. There's different letters in Hebrew. And so instead of saying, well, they probably thought they were saying Shibboleth, but when it came out, it was Sibboleth. It's kind of like I always make fun of my wife because she was born in Houston. But when she says it, I hear her saying Houston, like the H is silent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say Houston. And she says, Houston. So in her mind, she is hearing it. She's hearing herself say it the exact way that I say it. And it's probably the same way with these men of Ephraim. They probably thought they were saying Shibboleth, but instead it came out as Sibboleth. And that was, you know, we still have that terminology in English. Sometimes if someone's talking about like code language or kind of in-group language, they'll use that word Shibboleth as a reference to that. So anyway, this is the end of the story of Jephthah.
It's wrapped up. And it's interesting how, I mean, this obviously has to do with his story, but this kind of has nothing to do with God saving Israel, right? This is, so you have God's working to save Israel, and then you have man's like side projects and side offenses going on, mm-hmm. right? And so you see it's all terribly human. Terribly.
It kind of shows you the ongoing strife and civil wars within among the various tribes. There's no unity, and there really won't be. When you really look at the span of Israel's history, there are extremely short periods of time when they are unified as a nation. I mean, of course they weren't really unified when they were the 40 years in the wilderness, because you had all kinds of disunity even back then. People were rebelling against Moses. You know, the earth opening up and swallowing Dathan and others. So you had issues way back then. But once they get to the promised land, yeah, it's pretty short-lived. I mean, they seem to be unified in the days of Joshua. But after he dies, the unity begins to break up. And it's sort of like every tribe's just kind of doing their own thing. And sometimes two or three of them will band together, and sometimes two or three of them will fight each other. And it's not going to get any better until really the rule of King David. So during King David's reign and during Solomon's reign, not the very beginning of David's reign, because it took some time. For a while, only his own tribe recognized him as king, but he finally brought unity to the kingdom. And then Solomon maintained that unity. But then after that, it's over. So yeah. For, you know, less than a century, Israel was actually, all 12 tribes were unified. And then after that, you have the breakup. After Solomon dies, you have the northern kingdom breaking away from the southern kingdom, and they never were reunified.
Yeah.
So the broad stretch of Israelite history is one of disunity rather than unity.
Yeah, it kind of seems like the only time they're unified is when there's some massive thing that they need to do. You know, so
yeah, like building the temple or something.
Yeah, Joshua coming in and says, we got to take this land, and so we're going to need everybody. You know, and you kind of see this play out in modern day. I mean, in the United States, our states don't go to war with each other. We have in our history. Our history is not that long. And there was one time where we all killed each other, which is pretty horrible. Mm-hmm. But then you see the moments where sort of this thing rises up and everybody like lays down all the other differences to get to, you know, World War II is an example of this. And the country is extremely unified. because you have like this sort of common cause, right? But
right.
But the rest of the time, we're always fighting with each other and arguing and pointing fingers at each other, and that's how the vast majority of our time is spent until something rises where we're like, oh, I guess we got to lay that stuff down for right now and deal with this thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that is sociologically, I think that is true. There's nothing that will bring people together like a common enemy or a common cause. But when that disappears, it's like people then turn and start looking at the people around them and either come up with a real or an imaginary excuse for going to war, either metaphorically or literally.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you saw this kind of stuff happen. This is just human nature. This happens in the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think that you get all united to get this thing done, but as soon as that thing's done, then it's all kinds of splintering and factions and all this. I mean, this is just the way humans work, man.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just goes to show, as I've said before, talking about Cain and Abel, that it's like all of human history is prophesied in Cain and Abel. Genesis 4 is like all human history squeezed into a few verses where people who are close to each other fight. And often there's bloodshed as a result. So anyway, we see that here at the close of Jephthah's story, where this is not God's doing. This is just two tribes having it out and a whole lot of people dying as a result. So anyway, that's the end of the story of Jephthah. And following him, we have three very short descriptions of the next judges. So they're minor judges. We don't really know a whole lot about them. Verse 8 says that there was a guy from Bethlehem named Ibzan. This could be one of two Bethlehems. There's actually two Bethlehems in Israel. One is up in among the tribe of Zebulun, and the other is the Bethlehem that we're all familiar with. So it's not exactly sure, but I suspect that this was probably the tribe of the Bethlehem that was in the tribe of Zebulun's territory. But anyway, we don't know anything about him really, except that he judged Israel, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters. So no doubt he was rich and powerful because he would have had multiple wives. And says that he gave his daughters in marriage outside the family, and then he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. So probably the same kind of thing going on that happens with kings, right? Where you're trying to forge bonds with other countries, and so you know you're the king of Germany, so you give your daughter in marriage to the king of the prince of France, and this kind of politicking was going on in ancient Israel just like it does till today. But anyway, that's all we know. He judged Israel for 7 years, and then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem.
It's interesting that he only judged Israel for 7 years, and the only information you have is that he has 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he brings in 30 daughters for his son, and you're like, did this all take place in this 7 years? Like, how, like, you know, it's, that would be, that's a lot of daughters to bring in, yeah, while you're trying
a lot of weddings.
It's a lot of weddings. That means that you had a lot of people pregnant at the same time, early on. I mean, it's a weird little short description.
Yeah. And we're also not told, but it says he judged Israel. What did he do? I mean, was he kind of the classic definition of a judge? Was he delivering Israel from some sort of enemies that aren't even specified? Or was he more of kind of a, what we think of as a judge who is acting to resolve disputes between people? Probably he was a military judge, just like many of the others, but we don't know exactly who he would have been fighting against. The next guy is from the tribe of Zebulun. His name is Elon or Elon, and we know even less about him. We know that he judged Israel 10 years, and then he died and was buried, and that's all. We don't even know how many kids he had. Maybe he was a bachelor.
Yeah.
Maybe he was maybe he didn't have a family.
He only had 15 kids, so it wasn't noteworthy.
Oh, yeah, not even worth mentioning. So we got one more in this chapter. And his name is Abdon, the son of Hillel. Hillel is going to be a famous name among the Jews later on. One of the famous rabbis was Rabbi Hillel. And he had, wow, he even outdid the first judge we talked about here. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons. And get this, they rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel for 8 years. The donkey reference is probably a reference to the fact that, you know, this was a powerful family and kind of a ruling type of family. We just celebrated Palm Sunday when we're recording this. It's Tuesday of Holy Week, so we just passed Palm Sunday. But that's one of the significances of the fact that Jesus rode a donkey. This was part of the Old Testament heritage. Often those who were in some kind of power capacity, authority capacity, a king or a judge, they would be separated from others by not walking, but riding on donkeys, just like Solomon rode on David's donkey. So this particular judge has these 40 sons, 30 grandsons, and they're on these 70 donkeys to kind of set them apart. And it says he judged Israel for 8 years, and then he died, and he was buried in the hill country of the Amalekites. And that's it. That's it for the chapter, and that's it for those three minor judges. That's all we know about them. So now we are going to enter into a long section in the book of Judges. This is one of the longer sections, if not the longest one, and it's all about probably the judge that's most well-known. I mean, Gideon's pretty well-known, and Samson's pretty well-known, but Samson probably is his story, and maybe the details in the story, is probably more well-known than any of the judges, just because there's a lot of kind of strange things that happened to him, and his physical powers, of course, are well-known. His hair, everybody knows about Samson's hair. I mean, to think that a story from the book of Judges makes its way into pop music, that says a lot, right? I'm trying to help me out here. I'm trying to think of the song where Samson and Delilah. Well, there's more than one. There's a country song about Samson and Delilah, and
there's Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah has references.
Yeah, Hallelujah. That's it. Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's what I was trying to think of. Yeah,
David as well, but Samson and Delilah. There's a song by the Plain White Tees just called "Hey There, Delilah," which is not really about Samson and Delilah, I don't think, but maybe.
Maybe, yeah. But it's kind of crazy to think that this story from the book of Judges would work its way into popular culture.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the only part of the book of Judges that has done that. Of course, other parts of the Bible have too, but it's like everybody knows about Delilah. But she wasn't the only woman in Samson's life, as we will find out shortly. You can kind of divide his life into segments based upon his connection with women. His mother first, and then he has his wife, and then she's killed, she's murdered, and then you have a prostitute, and then you have Delilah, and we know that she was part of Samson's undoing. But anyway, there's a whole lot that will be very interesting to talk about when we delve into various aspects of his life.
Well, it's interesting. Now, it's interesting in the scriptures. If you were to try to figure out who the shadiest, most manipulative dude in the Bible was, there'd be a lot of guys in the running. Because there's a ton of them. But if you were to say, who's the shadiest, most manipulative woman in the Bible, I think almost everyone would immediately be like, oh, it's got to be Delilah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like she stands above the rest. Because by and large, the women are actually, in the scriptures, are actually, they present much better than the men.
Yes, they do.
And there's a lot of dudes that you could be like, well, there's a lot of scumbags. But as far as women go, Delilah, I think that's part of the reason that she's unique, is because she's one of the only women in the scriptures that you're like, man, she seems like she is trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Delilah and Jezebel, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they are just about the worst. But yeah, Delilah, I mean, Jezebel just kind of comes across as pure evil, right?
Yeah.
But Delilah's different. I mean, yeah, she's seductive and manipulative and won't give up. She's in it for the money.
Dude, the power that she has over Samson when we get there seems ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you read that part of the story, you're like, dude, do you not realize what's happening here?
Like, you need better friends, Samson. Like, how come none of your boys are not coming up to you like, dude, you got to cut this off?
Yeah, like, are you so blinded by love or lust that you don't realize what's happening here? But anyway, we will get there. First of all, we have to hear about his birth story, which is fascinating in and of itself. We have just all kinds of unusual things happening here with his birth story. So we'll jump into it. This is chapter 13. So it says the Israelites did evil again in the sight of the Lord. Nothing new there. And the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. Now that's significant because that's a long period of time. And this is really when you begin to see, this particular story is really when you begin to see the Philistines emerging as the arch enemy of the Israelites. We've heard about the Philistines early in the book of Judges, a few other scattered places. But from this point on, if you were to ask an Israelite who the major threat was, they wouldn't point to the Amalekites or to the Ammonites or the Moabites or any of those people or Egypt or any major nation. Instead, they'd point to the people that lived really in their own land along the Mediterranean in a strip there of several cities known as the Philistines. Philistines are just one of those ancient peoples where it's kind of cloaked in mystery as to where they came from. Most people believe that they came from the Aegean. And most scholars think that they kind of got stuck there. It's like they migrated in and they were trying to go into Egypt, possibly even to conquer Egypt. But we do have historical records saying that one of the pharaohs fought against them and defeated them. So probably what happened is they were on their way to Egypt and they were met by the Egyptian army and they were defeated. So rather than fulfilling the ultimate goal of capturing Egypt or at least taking part of Egypt, they actually stopped. And they settled there along the Mediterranean and built these cities. And in the rest of the book of Judges, in the time of Samuel, and then all the way into the story of David, it's the Philistines who again and again are going to attack Israel. Now, one of the things that is distinct about this particular time period relative to the Philistines is that it seems as if the Israelites are basically wanting to live at peace with the Philistines. You know, a lot of times these other tribes or these other peoples will come in and the Israelites are actually like crying out to God, you know, deliver us, send somebody to help us, save us. But there's nothing like that happening here. In fact, in a couple of the stories of Samson, it's like the Israelites are trying everything within their power to just kind of keep things calm and maintain peace with the Philistines. So they don't want any trouble with the Philistines, but Samson is the one who's causing problems, and it's really not even Samson. God is using Samson to kind of stir up strife. So it's kind of like he sees that his people have become so lax that they don't even get upset by the Philistines. And so God's going to poke the bear. He's going to try and stir up strife by using Samson to create this friction between the Israelites and the Philistines so that he'll kind of wake them up and make them realize that they shouldn't be tolerating the situation that they're in. Anyway, that's the Philistines. Now we're going to move out from that kind of broad focus on them to a very narrow focus upon one man and one woman, and one woman in particular who... You know, we talked a few minutes ago that there's hardly anybody in the book of Judges who kind of stands out as sort of pious or faithful. If there is one, it would be the mother of Samson. There seems to, you know, she seems to come across at least as someone who is genuinely interested in doing God's will. Her husband kind of comes across as a buffoon, as we'll see as the story goes on. He kind of comes across as like, He's sort of thin skinned and he feels like he's being left out because the angel keeps appearing to his wife. And when he asks the angel questions, he doesn't get any direct answers. So his wife kind of comes out in the story as the one who's really figured things out and understands what God's will is. But anyway, there was this guy, a certain man, we're told first, of Zorah, the family of the Danites. So he's from the family of Dan, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren and had borne no children. So typical theme, typical biblical theme coming up, right? Sarah, Rebecca, we have Elizabeth. A lot of stories in the scriptures where you have a barren wife who is about to be confronted by a promise of God that she's going to bear children. Verse 3 says that to this particular woman, the Malach Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, and the messenger of the Lord, appeared and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now, therefore, be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. Several interesting things just right away in this particular story. First of all, if you're a longtime listener to 40 Minutes, we don't really need to go into who the angel of the Lord is very briefly. In Hebrew, Malach just means messenger, usually translated angel, but it just means messenger. So this is the messenger of God. And this messenger, as we'll see even in this chapter, speaks with divine authority. So he's not a created angel. He's the divine messenger. So this is the word or the glory or the son of Father. So in New Testament language, this is Christ who is appearing to this particular family, which is pretty cool, you know, because there's a lot of language in here that actually echoes the same language that's going to be spoken to Mary, right?
So, yeah, only by someone that we know for sure is an angel. This is one of the ways that you know the difference is that Christ does not come, you know, Jesus does not come to Mary and say, "You're going to bear me."
Right.
This is not how it works. Instead, we have an actual angel come. That angel has a name. Probably the most famous angel of all, Gabriel. Maybe Michael's in the running, but I think probably more kids know who Gabriel is.
Yeah.
So here you have. This is what's cool about it is, I mean, there's going to be obvious parallels between the birth of Samson and the birth of Christ, this sort of miraculous birth of a savior. As he will begin, and even this language, he will begin to save Israel. By the way, he will not complete the saving of Israel. That will belong to Christ. But he will begin to save Israel. And that this is announced, the fact that this would be announced by Christ, who would complete the work of salvation, is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. That is pretty cool. It's like Jesus prepares the language for his own birthday, right?
Yeah.
Or for his own conception. So anyway, that's who the angel of the Lord is. If you're a new listener, go back and listen to Exodus chapter 3, the discussion of Moses, the burning bush, where we talk a lot more about who this is. Anyway, so this divine messenger says, you're barren. Well, that's no news. She realizes that already, but then he has his promise. Now, you can't tell this in the English, and I checked a couple of translations, and both the translations had the same thing, but there's a change that takes place in the Hebrew. So in verse 3, he says, you shall conceive and give birth to a son. But then when you get to verse 5, the tense of the verb changes, and it's no longer a future. It's actually a past, or you can translate it as a present. So in verse 3, he makes the promise, you shall conceive. But then in verse 5, he says, you have conceived, or you are pregnant. So it's almost as if in the very appearance of this divine messenger is when this conception takes place, which is even cooler when you compare that then to Christ himself and the announcement of the angel. But whether that actually happened then or not, that seems to be what is implied by the Hebrew there, that change from future to present. So you're going to conceive, and in fact, you already have. And the Nazarite quality of this child is different too. We talked about the Nazarites way back when we were discussing the Torah, but the Nazarites were usually set apart in three different ways. First of all, they took a vow that was temporary, usually temporary in nature. You hardly ever had a lifelong Nazarite, but Samson is going to be one. And part of what they vowed was that they wouldn't cut their hair and that they would not touch any carcass or corpse of a person. So no contact, no direct contact with death. And then thirdly, that they would not drink any kind of alcoholic beverage. So what's going to set Samson apart here is, first of all, this is a lifelong vow. It's not going to be something that he does temporarily. And he's going to begin this already from the womb, so that even his mother is not allowed to consume the beverages, which by virtue of her being pregnant would affect would affect the child. The prohibition there, by the way, not to drink wine or strong drink. The word for strong drink is shekar. It probably refers to actually to beer. So there's a lot of references in ancient Near Eastern literature to a beverage like this. In fact, they've even found among Philistines, interestingly, these vessels were basically the ancient beer jugs. But the beer would have so much sediment in it that there was a filtering system where you would drink out of it, and there were little bitty holes that would catch the residue. So when you were drinking the beer, you wouldn't get a mouthful of all the stuff that was on the bottom of it. But we have records that a lot of the pharaohs and Mesopotamian kings actually included in the ration list for people so much beer. And maybe it was a small jug, maybe it was a gallon of beer that would be given to them. So beer was well known, and probably that's what was been talked about here. So no wine, no beer for the mother, and then of course for Samson as well. And no razor to pass upon his head. And then we have, of course, as you talked about, this description of his vocation, that he shall begin to deliver Israel. So that kind of gets us into the story a little bit. We're out of time, so I guess we're going to pick up on the story of Samson and the rest of this back and forth between this divine messenger and this soon-to-be mother and father when we get together next week.
Yeah, and this back and forth that we're going to see between the father and the angel of the Lord, there's one of the more interesting exchanges that you see in the angel of the Lord will have with somebody.
Yeah, it's a long conversation.
It is, yeah. You get more information that will definitely lead you to believe this isn't just some angel. Like, angels don't talk this way.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So
stay tuned.
All right. Well, guys, there's a lot of additional content that we're trying to put out there. So, you know, stay tuned to the appropriate mediums. We're putting stuff out on Facebook all the time. Go over to the YouTube. I'll put a link to the YouTube channel in the show notes, so you can just click on that and you can check out those videos from Chad and other people. And we'll see you here next week.